I make my way back down to the study and sit on the sofa. I find my laptop in the kitchen and pull up the portal where I post cases for the college. And there it is, solving baby doe. I'd shared the case with students, past and present. Anyone can sign up for a class and gain access. And Wade told me he'd found my class. He'd said it was clever. Wade is not going anywhere. He's been on my street, in my home, and now in my head. He'll know everything I've ever done with forensic evidence. Something tells me he'll be a quick study. Wade, the 404. No, Wade. The name sticks in my mind because I'm still on that road, letting him into my life. I think about the plan we made today with Aaron, how they're watching my phone, searching for clues. Wade has found a way around that now, which means he knows the protocol. And he'll know what comes next.
Chapter 12. The Kill Room. The situation with the raked path leading to the shelter and the similar story from Colorado cannot be mere coincidence. Using a pull rake to remove tire tracks from a crime scene is so unusual that they have still only found this one prior case. They decide that whoever planned and executed this crime that has left them with a burned body has been using the internet for information about forensics and evidence and, more specifically, how to evade detection. The case from Colorado made the local news, but they have yet to find it in other online sources. They consider the possibility that the killer moved to Connecticut from Colorado, where he first learned about the rake. They wonder if he has killed before, using knowledge he acquires as needed. They work quickly as the leaves fall, searching the other smaller shelters, the woods in between. After the leaves will come the snow, and then any evidence on the ground will be buried. They gather a small team to do nothing but search for online materials that match the forensics found at the shelter and inside the kill room, but just like the evidence, it's either too much or too little to be useful. For example, when they search for ways to dispose of a body, cremation is right at the top, along with acid and in large bodies of water. One of the investigators recalls a story from 30 years ago when he worked homicide in New York. Yes, he should be retired, but after trying it out for 6 months, he decided to take some of his pension from New York and work part-time in Connecticut. It was that, or his marriage. His wife told him, he wasn't built to play golf or fiddle with shit in the garage. The case involved a mob soldier, the guy who kills people and disposes of their bodies when needed, or leaves them for all to see as a message to a rival or snitch. They had been after him for years, hoping to turn him. He tells the team how the guy was finally caught and convicted using evidence found in his apartment and one severed finger unearthed by a dog in Queens. His MO was to cut up his victims and bury their body parts in different boroughs. He knew each borough worked its own cases, so a hand found in the Bronx and a torso in Central Park and a finger in Queens were not likely to be connected. But, he said, there was a book in the suspect's apartment about hiding bodies. It was a self-published how-to guide only sold in the places one might suspect. S&M shops, the classifieds of fringe magazines. Step by step, the guy followed that book, cutting up the bodies in his bathtub, pulling the teeth, burning the fingertips and face with acid, then burying the pieces in different jurisdictions. Once investigators found that book, they reached out to neighboring jurisdictions and coordinated their investigations. In the end, they had partial remains of 9 different bodies. From there, they looked into missing persons cases to identify the victims. The bodies, the book, and traces of blood in his bathtub drainpipe were all used at the trial. The trouble here, his colleagues reminded him, was that they didn't have a suspect. If they did, they could possibly connect him to some browser history that matched the forensics. Even that would be a stretch, though. They would need the equivalent of blood in the drainpipe to seal the deal. Still, it was all they had. So they looked, for hours on end, for anyone or anything they could connect to the Pullrake story and for a possible victim. One of the areas of focus is the killing from 3 years back, the one that made the kill room a thing people talked about, the one that exposed the shelters and the cremation oven. The media attention was fleeting, not enough to get any kind of momentum to tear these things down or put an end to the hunting season. They compile a database of all the sites that carried the story, from major news outlets to chat rooms and social media. They plan to do this for the Pullrake story from Colorado, specific information about cremation, and eventually, perhaps, find one source where all of these stories have been present. Where they'll go from there, they don't know, but at least they'll have an idea of what site this killer frequents to add to his toolbox. They have yet to discover the local community college that allows a former professor to update her online materials with new cases. Access to that portal requires enrollment, which costs money, and does not appear in their Google searches. What seems promising is a new lead from missing persons in Westchester County. Because of the traces of oxy found in the red jacket, and the fact that the killing here 3 years ago was drug-related, and also a new discovery made in the well that fed the water pump in the kill room, a rope connected to a mesh bag that had balloons of oxy, indicating the well was used as a hiding place for the supply. They had focused on narcotics CIs and missing persons who had not been reported as missing. The CIs knew who came and went and who didn't return. This was not uncommon. People in this line of work moved around, changed locations, went to jail in other jurisdictions. Their families didn't file reports when they failed to show up for Sunday dinner. No cops. No cops. No cops. Not ever. But now, a CI from a small city halfway between the shelters and the Bronx had been asked and given the answer that became the subject of this new lead. A young guy, a kid really, who'd been on the scene for over a year or so, hadn't been around lately. The CI gave a description, and the cops working that area matched it to a surveillance photo. He went by the name Nix. That photo was then circulated to narcotics units in other areas, including Connecticut. There was nothing local, but sure as shit, they got a match from surveillance down near the river in the town where the Nichols shooting happened just last month. The river under the bridge. One of the investigators recalls that the shooter, Clay Lucas, had been seen under that same bridge days before walking into the department store and shooting up the place. But unlike the situation with the rake, they write this one off as a coincidence.
Chapter 13. I don't tell anyone about my discovery in the early morning hours inside my home, or what the message on the burner contained and what all of this implies. I don't have a plan. I just know that it gives me options beyond Rowan and Aaron and the department that is tracking Wade's communications with me. I can see the risks if I tell them, so keeping it a secret, for now, feels safer. Wade wants a direct line to me, a private way to communicate. He wants my attention while he plays his game. Is he proving himself to me so I'll see that we are somehow connected? Is he torturing me for not wanting it? Whatever this is, it has to do with me and only me. And if I let people get in the way of that, I could push him into a deeper psychosis, force him to take more drastic measures. This limits my resources. He's accessed the portal at the college where I posted my updates, which means he's registered for a class or hacked his way in. He might have stolen a student's ID and password. There are so many ways he could have gained access, and our techies might find it. But that feels remote. He'll know how to cover his tracks. Maybe I'm the delusional one, thinking I can contain him on my own. That by having complete control of my chessboard, without others telling me what move to make next, instilling doubt and second-guessing, I can beat him. But it feels like the only way out, to play this private game with him. If I tell the people who love me, who want to protect me, I know they'll stop me. And if I bring the department in, they'll make me follow rules. So I walk down this road, alone. I hope I'm taking small enough steps that I can find my way back if I'm making a mistake. Rowan and I visit the missing social worker's parents when they arrive from Oregon. Their daughter, Laurel Hayes, has been out of touch for 2 weeks, and it is only now sinking in that she might be in danger. Or worse. They move as though they are two parts of one person, finishing each other's sentences, anticipating the needs of the other without a word. Richard Hayes gets his wife a glass of water from the bathroom of their hotel room. They are visibly shaken and aren't sure where to go or what to do. Laurel's apartment has been turned upside down by forensics, and they don't want to be at the police station. So they stay here, waiting for news. Cora Hayes sits on the edge of the bed while Rowan and I lean on the bureau across from it. "Did she ever mention a patient named Clay Lucas?" Rowan asks her.
"The man from the shooting?"
"Yes," he confirms. Cora seems surprised.
"Well, of course. He was at the daycare center not 2 months ago."
Richard is back and chimes in. "We called her when we heard about the shooting, made sure she was safe and sound. But then she called back later that night to tell us about this young man after his name was released. She was pretty upset."
Rowan looks at me, wondering if I'm going to pick up on this and ask the next question. Partners develop a kind of dance with interviews, and this is ours. But I'm not paying attention to the music. Wade's burner phone is in my pocket, and I feel like a walking time bomb, like he could trigger it at any moment.
Rowan gives up on me. "Did she say why she was upset?" he asks.
Cora answers, "Well, obviously it was unsettling to her that someone she spent time with every day for several months had that kind of violence in him. I still get a shiver thinking about it."
Richard sits beside his wife and gently places a hand on her knee. "It was more complicated than that," he tells us.
Cora hangs her head, and I know that look. She's worried about what we'll think when her husband finishes his thought, what conclusions we might jump to about her child.
"Laurel has always been a compassionate person," he explains, "always taking in the stray animal, making friends with the kid no one wanted to sit next to at lunch. It's why she went into social work."
"She has a big heart," Cora adds. "She only sees the good."
Richard nods. "She took a special interest in this young man. When she called back that night, she told me she was afraid she'd gotten too close to him, that she'd crossed a line. She said he was like a friend. There weren't a lot of patients around her age. She's just 23. Most of the patients are older than her grandparents."
I jump in now. "Did she know about his condition?"
"Yes, of course," Richard says. "She told us that when he was taking his medication, he was a gentle soul."
"A sweet kid," is how she described him,
Cora interjects. "She felt that maybe she missed something. Apparently, he grew quite fond of her. He would always do whatever activity she was leading, sit by her when they were watching TV, things like that. She was so upset when she called that night. She felt responsible, even though it wasn't her fault and we told her that. Both of us, didn't we?"
Cora takes her husband's hand in her own and reassures him.
"We did. And she knew in her mind that she did nothing wrong. But her heart was heavy. His family withdrew him from the center because they couldn't afford it anymore. They thought they could supervise him at home. Laurel had no contact with him after he left."
Richard looks at us now. "No contact. She made sure to tell us that. She hadn't seen him for several weeks."
Rowan nods his head to reassure them that no one is judging their daughter for her compassion. He then looks at me, and this is my cue to play the bad cop and ask the harder questions.
"Did she say anything else about Clay that was bothering her?"
Things that in hindsight might have been warning signs? Did you talk about guns or killing, for example? They answer in unison, no, which under different circumstances would cause suspicion. But this felt genuine, like they'd been thinking it themselves.
There was nothing like that. She felt guilty because she didn't see any of those things, Richard explains.
We switch gears to her friends, possible love interests, co-workers she spoke about, then to her history, college, graduate school, former employers. No red flags appear, and we leave after reassuring them that maybe she just needed to get away, sort out her ambivalence about her interactions with Clay Lucas. Richard says that she does like to hike, and Cora agrees. Yes, she likes to be alone sometimes, unplug for a while. They make a plan to call some of the hiking hostels she used to stay at.
She even walked part of the Appalachian Trail, Richard tells us. There's a place in New Hampshire she stayed.
We leave them to this task, knowing it will keep them busy and hopeful. We do not share their optimism, but don't let on. There's no point. 10 minutes later, we're headed back to the station, running through theories and initial impressions of Laurel Hayes and her family.
I think she was more involved than she let on, Rowan says.
100%, I agree. She overstepped somehow. Maybe kept seeing him after he left. Checking in on the family. The guilt doesn't make sense. She was well-trained. She knew anything could happen if he went off his meds.
Didn't tell her parents the whole story because she didn't want them to be disappointed.
Right.
Do we think she might have been suicidal? Over the guilt?
I shake my head. I don't know. The parents seem like pretty forgiving people. But let's not rule out anything. We take a beat to consider where to turn next. The team working the case already spoke to the Lucas family, and they said they didn't know Laurel Hayes. We consider circling back to Clear Horizons and looking for a coworker willing to come clean about just how close Laurel and Clay Lucas had become, and whether she spoke about seeing him after he left. We're almost at the station when my phone chimes. It's not the burner phone, so I take it out and check the message. Rowan glances at me the moment I see the number. It's Wade, using this phone again. I let out one word, a whisper of disbelief.
No.
What is it?
I don't answer. It's a link to some kind of live feed, which I open and watch.
No.
I say this one word again, louder, as the image registers. A school playground. Recess. Kids on swings and monkey bars and climbing towers, throwing balls and kicking balls and standing in small groups talking. Running, chasing each other in games of tag. I've been in this scene. Recess at my girl's school. The video plays in real time because it's after lunch and that's when they go out. I've been there on enough visiting days to know what I'm seeing. I search the bodies for Fran's yellow sweater and Amy's black skirt, for flying curls and a long ponytail, for Mitch's eyes and my nose. And then my search is assisted by a zoomed focus, first on Fran running across a stretch of grass, then Amy with two girls just beyond the basketball hoop. In and out, the camera takes me to my children. My children being watched by Wade.
The school, I say. I don't even look at Rowan. I just tell him, go to the school.
Rowan puts on the lights and the siren and steps on the gas. I hold the phone in my hand and stare at the feed, which zooms out again. My eyes dart between different pieces of Wade's show, following Fran, checking back on Amy. Rowan calls the school. It goes to the automated system, then a prompt, and I say the extension with a trembling voice. We're transferred to the principal's office, where a woman named Marjorie answers. Every parent knows Marjorie. She's the one to call if your child is sick or didn't finish her homework or needs an extra day for vacation. She's the one who now asks what's wrong when she hears the sirens. She asks with great alarm, and I take a moment to think this through. I grab Rowan's phone from the dashboard mount and take it off the speaker. And he calls in for backup on the radio for any cars that might be closer to the school. He tells them to proceed cautiously. No lights or sirens.
Sorry about that, I tell Marjorie. It's Elise Sutton.
She asks me if something is happening, and I know she's thinking back to that shocking day when everyone within 10 miles of Nichols heard sirens as responders raced to the scene. I tell her there's nothing to worry about, a fender bender on the highway, some units dispatched to deal with traffic, and that's not why I'm calling. I ask her to give my girls a message, tell them that I will pick them up today, so they shouldn't get on the bus. I think they have recess now, I say, and she says, oh yes, of course, I'll get the message to them. I need her to go outside and call my children to one place. I need her eyes on my babies. Even as my voice trembles, we say polite goodbyes, and I keep watching until we pull up on the street across from the playground. When we do, the video cuts off. Look for the truck, I tell Rowan. He drives around the perimeter of the school. We don't veer off because the children are still outside. Luring cops from an active scene to chase after a suspect is one of the things I used to teach in my classes. Wade knows. He knows because he's accessed my online materials, which means he's inside my head. There's always a way to get around the police. I can see the words as I typed them into a case study about a kidnapping. I make Rowan park across from the playground where I can watch. I see my girls now, in the flesh. Marjorie is there speaking with their teachers, giving them the message. And then the teachers find them and pass it along, and then recess is called to an end, and the kids meander slowly back to the side entrance of the school. When they close the door, I lose it. Everything I'm holding in pours out. I'm going to find him, and I'm going to kill him. The words come between heaves of breath and streams of tears. I pound my fist into the dashboard. I will kill him. Rowan doesn't react, except to reach for my phone. Is it still there? He pulls up the message, but the link has expired. Maybe they captured something at the station, he thinks out loud. But I know they didn't. Wade wouldn't take that chance. Rowan scrolls for a bit, then looks up at the playground. What was the angle? He asks me. Where was he filming from? I take a deep breath and wipe my face. I look across the street and try to remember what I saw on the screen. The back of the school is directly across from where we're parked. The playground is a large rectangle that flanks the building. A wire mesh fence surrounds the perimeter. To the right, there's a patch of woods, the backyard of an abutting property. To the left is the street corner, and across from it, a row of hedges and then the front lawn of another parcel. I saw Amy with her friends. She was there, behind the basketball hoop. I point to the area and try to remember. Fran was running away from the camera, on the grass. There, I say, pointing to a different spot. The building was to her right. I look at the vantage points, the woods, the hedges, the streets, and it falls into place. He was on foot. Rowan gets out of the car. Thinking through the scene changes my focus, and I settle enough to do my job. I join Rowan, then walk to the spot where the scene matches what I saw on the feed. We're in front of the woods. It's impossible to gauge exactly how far away from the playground he was. He was zooming in and out. He was close, I say. The view wasn't obstructed. I walk 4 or 5 yards beyond the tree line and stop, turn around, and walk forward a couple of feet. Here, I say. Rowan checks the brush for anything he might have left, but of course, there is nothing. He turns slowly in a circle, looking for ways in and out. We walk through the woods to the house, around to the front, and ring the bell. No one's home. Beyond their front yard is another street, and we think that maybe he parked there, walked the path we just did in reverse, and used the cover of the trees to observe and film the playground. And my girls. We go to the street and do all of the things we know to do, not because we're remotely hopeful we'll find a damned thing, but because I have to do something, and Rowan knows it. When we're done, when we've exhausted everything we know to do, I walk back toward the school. One thought echoes in my head. Get your children. Rowan follows. Wait. But I keep moving, faster now, around the corner until I see the entrance. The instinct overwhelms me. I need to get inside that building. Rowan grabs my arms and stops me. Elise, wait. I try to break free. Rowan does a visual sweep.
Think,
he whispers and holds me to him, tighter and tighter until I can't move and my body stops fighting. He doesn't have to say more. I know what it will do to them if I enter the building, calling out their names, hysterical, terrified. The moment will stay with them. It will never leave. It will change the way they see the world, the way they see me and our life, the wires inside their heads. Okay, I tell him, promising. I'm okay. He lets me go and takes my face in the palms of his hands.
They're safe, Elise. They're safe.
And I repeat the words until I know it's true. They're safe. The moment passes, and we find ourselves back at the car. I'm wired, but also exhausted. We get inside, but Rowan doesn't drive. He takes my phone and looks at a message that preceded the live feed, searching for something that might help us find Wade.
He said this before, Rowan reminds me. I just want to see you.
I nod and catch my breath, wipe my face. I'm a mess inside and out. And now he's threatening my family. I stare at the phone, even though the live feed is gone.
What do you want to do?
For the first time in my life, I don't see a path forward. Wade is a ghost, and we have nothing to go on. No prints or hair or soda cans or coffee cups. No vacuum dust from a dumpster or tire marks or even a license plate. We have a facial composite. Witnesses to a crime that happened over 2 weeks ago, their memories now compromised by time. A community weary of the story, changing the channel. It's next to nothing. The resignation begins to settle in. I know how to do this work. Take my time, be patient and methodical.
But Wade is a lit fuse. We don't have that luxury.
I think about the burner phone. I think about telling Rowan, pulling it from my pocket and handing it over. I picture his face when I do. The anger that I waited. Then the determination to find this man and make him pay. And then what? I go down one of two roads. The first, traveled with my partner and the department, following the rules, keeping me safe first and foremost. It feels narrow and confined, and I know it will come to an end. Wade will stop using the phone and find another way to get to me. The second road feels wide and endless, and under my control. Looking at the crossroads, having taken my small steps, I can still see the way back. This feels like the point when I have to choose. I keep the phone in my pocket as a plan takes shape. He wants to see me, I tell Rowan. That's what all of this is about. It has to be the reason. Rowan shakes his head.
No. No way.
He's said this before when I've had an idea he doesn't like. I know how to get around him. A meeting in a public place. I'll go alone, but wear a wire. You'll know everything that's happening. You can be close by. He can't hurt me in a Starbucks. Rowan looks at me like I'm crazy. Maybe I am, but these are my children.
I don't think he's going through all of this just to have coffee with you.
So I'll ask him what he does want. Maybe if he sees me, if he can see that this is over and whatever he thought he could get from me is gone, he'll move on. I think it through as I talk. Hear me out, I plead with Rowan, my eyes back on the school where my children are safe, for now. What if he was just a man who was shopping for pants, and the things he did in that store came as a shock to him, so much so that they shattered his ego and made him seek a way to go back to his life, to his real job and his real name and the man he saw himself to be? He told me that was why he left Nichols, that he wanted to be the man he was before the shooting. Rowan wears a new expression now, something I haven't seen before. What? I ask him.
He was filming your girls at their school. And now you want to have a friendly chat and send him on his way? Back to his life before all of this?
He reminds me of the assault on Vera Pratt.
That's why he left the scene.
While he's talking me out of it, I begin to type a message.
Elise, Rowan says, what the hell are you doing?
I type until I'm done and hit send. What will he do next? What will he do to my family if I don't see him? If he shows, we'll get him. If he doesn't, then we've called his bluff, given in to his demands. and we'll move on to the next demand, and that will give us more information and buy us more time. Right now, we're the ones resisting, and it's making him angry. Look what he did today. To my girls. My voice shakes, and my face flushes with a surge of blood. These words are somehow bigger after they leave my mouth. Rowan takes the phone from my hands and reads the message. Tomorrow, 2 p.m., Ridgeway Diner.
You're not doing this, he says.
The phone chimes. I lean over and we read the reply together. Wade doesn't say anything I'm expecting, something like, come alone, or this better not be a setup. He doesn't insist we meet somewhere more secluded. He doesn't make any demands at all, and the burner phone remains dead silent in my pocket. He simply says,
see you then.
Chapter 14. I lie in bed with Mitch curled behind me, his chest tied up against my back, his arm tucked under mine, hands clutched together by my heart. So much has left us. Moments like this one had bound us together. The simplest gesture of how he held me, saying more than a million I love yous. I hadn't thought about it before. I'd taken it for granted. His hand in mine pulled to my heart. Every morning before we climbed out of bed to begin our days and our separate lives, we'd had this. Hands to heart, proof of our connection, our love, binding us together. We are bound together by something else now. Fear. Both of our hands tremble. We went through the options, not as a police family, but as terrified parents. Take them away somewhere. Send them to his mother in Florida. We've been over this already. If Wade wanted to get to them, he could follow, and to a place we couldn't control. Here, we knew the neighbors and the teachers and the kids who played in the street. We had an entire department looking out for us that now saw this as personal, one of their own being threatened. New measures were being put into place at the school, and our house was on virtual lockdown with an upgraded security system. Again, we decide to stay so I can find Wade and put an end to this. I leave our bed around midnight, as soon as Mitch has drifted off. I tiptoe into the girls' room, stare at them both a good long moment, then down the stairs to check on the detail. I can't make out their faces, the two colleagues who have given up their night to protect my family. Rowan says they like the extra pay and the time off during the day to see more of their kids, or sleep if they don't have kids, or do their laundry and binge-watch their shows. He tries to alleviate the guilt. The alarm system has been activated, and now any break of any seal, door or window, goes out to the detail and the dispatcher. No middleman. No well-checked phone call before the troops come storming in. None of this settles my nerves. I go to the kitchen and pour a glass of Mitch's scotch, the good stuff, which feels like magic when it hits my blood. Sitting at the kitchen table, I stare at the burner phone and think through the day that's passed and the day that's about to come. If Wade believed I had any intention of meeting him alone, he would have used this phone, which isn't being monitored. He would have asked to meet in a place he could control. He knows that I'm awake, here or on the sofa, thinking about him and his motives, and why he's letting me go through with this bullshit. It's hard to think through rage. It causes a physical reaction that produces chemicals. Rage begs and pleads for a reaction, and the body responds. It's primitive. I drink the scotch to fuck with the reaction. That's how I think of this battle being waged inside my head, with irreverence and determination. I will not succumb to any of it. Not the rage or the fear. Wherever the guilt over Clay Lucas is hiding, I let it stay there. The shooting and whatever else it's done to me locked away with it. In one of my classes, I presented a case study on stalking. I told the students that at the end, I wanted an answer to the question, why? It's the one crime that is certain to fail. Our case involved a woman who broke up with a man. There were no children, and they had only been together a few months. The man could not accept her decision. It began with text messages, dozens of them each day, protestations of love, analyses of her emotional flaws, why she couldn't accept his love. I'm not like the men before, the ones who have hurt you. Warnings about her future if she didn't take him back, how she would never find love again, how she was a piece of trash and lucky to have him. He used the same words Wade has used in his messages to me. Bitch. Cunt. The transition from love bombing to violent threats happened over a matter of days, the communications and actions starting with all love and ending with all hate, the ones in between mapping the shift within his mind. He didn't want to hate her. He didn't want to hurt her. Next came the sightings. He was outside her apartment, outside her office building, outside the grocery store, then inside, an aisle away, making sure she saw him and knew how close he was. She told the police, got a restraining order. There was nothing they could do. There were no stalking laws back then, and there is nothing uniform today. Even the states that have them do little in terms of enforcement. What did this man think would happen when he broke into her apartment, left a rose on her pillow, then a dead mouse, then a pile of dog shit? He found ways in no matter what she did. He dedicated his life to her every movement. Just like Wade getting into my house, spying on my children. Breathe in. Breathe out. Don't give in. My heart still races as I see the pattern. I asked my students, does he believe this woman will take him back? That threats and coercion will lead to genuine affection? If this is the motivation, it is delusional. Or is he simply unable to control his behavior? Is his obsession with her so big that he cannot turn away from it, that he has to satisfy it any way he can? Or is this about power and control? Does he know that every time he stalks her, he is causing a reaction, fear that disrupts her life? Does this replace the satisfaction he felt when they were together? Has he accepted the rejection and moved on to revenge? And in any of these scenarios, how will it end? I made them answer before we got to the conclusion of this one story, when he was outside her door demanding to be let in, when she called the police and begged them to come, when they arrived, walked him to his car, waited until he drove off and then left, and finally, when he returned half an hour later, broke down the door and stabbed her to death in her bed. Most of the students concluded that he was mentally ill. No sane person would believe that stalking behavior would lead to love, and his final act was certain to, and did, land him in jail for the rest of his life. In that case, they were right. The stalker was eventually diagnosed with a delusional disorder. But the research on stalkers and outcomes varies wildly. There are few predictors of the outcome, and the psychology of the stalker is usually not fully understood until the behavior stops, one way or another. I down the rest of the scotch and stare at the phone. What is happening here? There has to be a cause for this. Who was this man before the shooting? What did the shooting do to him? I cannot make assumptions. I have to gather evidence and apply possibilities and likelihoods without assuming one is right and the other is wrong. This unsettles me. The not knowing. The unsolved puzzle. The missing pieces I have to work now to find. I have to be clever enough to find them, even as the rage begs and pleads. That's what this is now. A game of wits. Maybe this is one of the pieces. Wade is enjoying this game with me. Maybe it's giving him back the power he lost when he stood on the other side of a loaded gun. Maybe he is having the response Dr. Landon warned me about, that he soothed himself with delusions about fate, that we were meant to be together. Whether it's true or not, he believes I saved his life, and now he craves a connection with me, even if the only form that takes is through this game he's playing. Maybe. 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 The word reignites more rage inside me as I hear it with every thought that searches for an answer. I pour a second glass of scotch. It's after one when I return to bed and crawl beneath the covers. Mitch finds my body with his and wraps us up together again, like people do when they love one another. I take from it what I can, the warmth, the safety in this moment. 5 hours later, my eyes dart open, and a deep, shocking breath rushes in. I wake from sleep like I'm waking from the dead. I listen to my house, to the radiator popping, and Mitch snoring, and something ticking, his watch on the dresser or the clock in the bathroom. Antiquated sounds from an old house, old fixtures and accessories, an older man than the one I married. I listen and feel at peace for a moment. Fran finds us, beside herself that we are both still in bed. She jumps in between us and snuggles all the way under the covers until she disappears. I hear her giggle when Mitch tickles her feet. He's good at this, at keeping things normal, at pretending. Just the sight of them triggers the same fear in him that it does in me after what happened at their school. My baby giggles and squirms and seeks refuge by climbing up and over me to the other side where her father can't reach her. She pleads for me to help, and I run my hand softly on the inside of his ear, which makes him yell, "Stop!" because that's the most sensitive place on his body. And I don't know why. Or maybe I do, but I wonder if Brianna knows this about him. If they made love that way, exploring every inch of skin with their hands, mouths, or if they just fucked half-dressed over a desk or against his truck or her car. It's a horrible thought. 4 years have passed, but it has been unearthed because of Wade, because he asked me things and I told him things that day on the outskirts of town, and now he's inside my head, making me think about what's inside of his. And from there, what's inside of anyone's. The not knowing is familiar and has brought me back in time. I had not seen the change in Mitch 4 years ago. I had not smelled her perfume on his clothes or felt her touch lingering on his skin. I found out through an acquaintance, someone who'd seen them in her car at a time when Mitch said he was still at the job site. And then I waited, and I watched. I investigated my own husband for 6 days, the way I would a suspect in one of my cases. The moment I finally caught them never leaves me. I hadn't seen it coming. Even with all of my training, I ignored the signs that were right in front of me, just like I ignored the alarm bells sounding off as I followed Wade to that back road. I wanted to believe my husband would never stray. I needed to believe Wade would save me from myself by giving me the answers I needed about the shooting. Human want, human need, they can be unstoppable. Rowan doesn't want me to meet Wade today, but Aaron has approved the operation, and he's the boss. We have to call Wade's bluff, force him to come out of hiding, or move on to his next demand, and see if that can tease out more information, more clues. There's nothing to be gained by staying in this stalemate, forcing him to escalate his behavior because I refuse to meet him. Aaron has assigned 2 units to stand by, one in the kitchen of the diner, one in an unmarked car parked outside. None of this will matter, though I keep this to myself. Wade knows how we work, the things to look for. He knows how to spot us and get around us because I posted it online and now he has it, all of it. Beyond this, we still have no idea who he is, where he's from, and what he might have learned before he ever met me. I hadn't seen my own husband having an affair. I would be foolish to think I can see Wade for what he is. Not yet. I pick up my daughter and set her down on the floor. Go tell Amy to get in the shower. I'll get breakfast. I give her a big kiss, and she runs off screaming her sister's name, knowing it will annoy her to be woken so abruptly. Years from now, Amy will remind her of what a pest she was, maybe at a graduation or a wedding, and with the laughter of shared memories and endearment. They will have that. Whatever I have to do now, I will make sure they see that day. I take my horrible thoughts about my husband with me to the bathroom and try to scrub them off as I wash my face and brush my teeth. I barely notice that the bruises have changed color. I've become used to them, accepting that they'll remain a part of me until this is all over. I'm still in my sweats from the night before, so I put on some deodorant and return to the bedroom. I'll shower later, after I get the girls on the bus. I'll need to choose my clothes carefully so I can cover the wire, and I can't think it through until they're gone, until the house is quiet. Mitch is still in bed when I open the door. What? I ask him, because his eyes follow me as I walk across the room. He smiles. It's sincere, but sad. Nothing, he says. But then, I'm just happy you came back up last night. I miss you. I crawl beside him and kiss him and say all the right things back. And he pulls me to him, thwarting my escape from the bed and the room and the thoughts that did not wash clean. He brings me into a giant bear hug, and I want to disappear, melt into his body. I am no longer steeled to what I have to do, and my breath grows short and erratic as I hold back a swell of emotion. Mitch can feel it. We've been here before. Hey, he says, lifting his head to look at me. You don't have to do this. He doesn't want me to meet Wade. He doesn't want me used as bait. I exhale long and hard. Then I answer him with as much truth as I can spare. I can't take much more of this. I have to find him and stop him. He squeezes me tighter, and I think he's about to say something comforting and consoling. But he doesn't, because there's nothing he can say that isn't just wishful thinking. The Ridgeway Diner is clearing out by 2. It's in between lunch and dinner. I sit at a booth across from the counter with the red leather stools. A waitress has poured 2 cups of coffee. Tape pulls at my skin where the wire is adhered, and I think that Wade will know it's there. He'll know everything about today because he is thinking backward, just like I taught him. He's pictured himself in an interview room, in custody, me and Rowan across from him, a folder on the table between us. He's thought through how he got there. The unmarked car in the parking lot, the unit in the kitchen, Rowan probably among them. He's thought about the thing he said that went through the wire and into Rowan's ear and the recorder stuffed into my bag. The thing that was enough for them to make their move. A confession. A threat. And then back before that, he's seen me at the table by the window, across from the counter that leads to the kitchen. Halfway to the front entrance and halfway to the back. No easy way in or out. And so I wait, letting the coffee get cold, knowing he won't show, that he never planned to. And yet, he needs to see me. Whatever his motivation, he isn't done with me. We won't catch him today, but it will provoke him. Something will come of this. I could have waited to contact him, told no one. I could have made promises that I would meet him alone, and he would have no choice but to assume I was lying. The time in between the making of the plan and the execution of the plan would make it impossible for him to know for certain. Whenever there is time, there is doubt. The element of surprise is a criminal's best weapon. I remember the examples I wrote about in that case study. The woman walking alone in a parking garage with her keys laced between her fingers, glancing over her shoulder, ready for anything. That's not your victim. It's the one who's forgotten about the danger, the one who hasn't pictured herself trapped in the trunk of a car on the way to that notorious second crime scene where she is sure to die. That's the one you want. I had written all of this down. Trust and distraction are common mistakes. Wade isn't coming. But planning this without Rowan, without Aaron, would have eroded their trust in me. I need that trust so I can continue to deceive them. The thought sounds crazy and rational all at once. Wade isn't coming, because he can never be certain I'm being honest when I say I'm alone. He will always assume there is a car in the lot and cops in the kitchen and a wire on my back. The next time we meet face to face, I won't see it coming. Chapter 15. The number one reason criminals get caught is lack of discipline. The ones who get away, the so-called masterminds, have impeccable self-control, motivated by calculation rather than emotion. Theft, for example, driven by desire for greater wealth, can be calculated. Theft driven by desperation, homelessness, starvation, especially involving a child or other loved one, will always involve emotion and therefore be vulnerable to mistakes. Murder, kidnapping, assault, the same rules apply. A crime of violence committed to send a message or eliminate a competitor, for example, can be calculated. A violent crime driven by anger, fear, jealousy, revenge. These will come littered with evidence that can be found and analyzed. Whether there is justice can't be predicted, of course. So much depends on the resources and intelligence of the good guys and the bad guys. But mistakes are most likely to be made when the brain is compromised by feelings. I'm about to officially give up on Wade showing when I see Rowan rushing out from the kitchen, the swinging doors slamming against the sides of the cake displays. "Go," he yells. "Go!" So I go. I race out after him and the second officer from our squad. I don't ask what's happened. I assume that they've spotted him or the truck and that he spotted them back and took off. This doesn't make sense to me. There's no way he would come this close. We get outside and survey the parking area. It's a small strip mall with parallel parking at the curb and angled spaces on either side of a grass median. Our people were in the last space at the end of the curb so they could get out quickly, which they have now done. They've popped the flashing red light on the roof of their SUV and are in full pursuit of a blue truck, both vehicles now out on the main road. We can't catch up to them, so we stand on the sidewalk and watch. Rowan holds his phone, pacing, excited. "Do we have him? Tell me we have him." We watch as both vehicles pull to the side, two lights down the road, specks off in the distance. And for a second, just one second, I let myself believe it's over. "What's happening?" I ask Rowan. Our colleague steps away, also on his phone, also getting an update. They hang up at the exact same time. Now the burner phone buzzes, and my hope leaves as quickly as it came. I knew better than to let it in. Rowan stares at the scene unfolding down the street, hands on his hips, shaking his head. "It's not him," he says. "Just some kid with a blue truck." Some kid who got paid $200 to drive through this parking lot, slow down in front of the diner, then drive at least two lights away, no matter who followed him. Some kid who got paid in Bitcoin, who communicated on Reddit with an account that is now gone. Vanished. "Fuck," Rowan says. "Fuck." I don't tell him about the messages that wait for me on the burner phone. Guilt tugs at my heart, but the plan is in my head and I cannot let it go. It has become my lifeline. The only way I see out of this. I have convinced myself, and there is no turning back. This is a game Wade and I must play alone. My nerves settle as we get back in our cars, me and my Subaru, Rowan and the other guy in the SUV parked around back. "They're bringing the kid to the station," Rowan tells me, and I agree we should talk to him and find out everything we can. I know already there will be no trace. Rowan doesn't take any chances. He watches me get in my car and lock the doors. I drive around back as they walk, then follow them. If Wade was hoping to create a diversion, pull the first unit away with the truck, then send me back to my car alone, it doesn't work. Of course, he knew it wouldn't, because it's the first thing I consider when we get the news about the truck. Wade is in my head, the way I am in his. I check the messages only when we're back inside the station, waiting for this kid with the blue truck who will be useless. The first is a video clip. There's no timestamp, but it's recent. Mitch grew a beard after the shooting. I think he felt exposed the way I did, and this made it better for him. It wasn't rational. Still, he'd never grown a beard before the shooting. Now here he is. With Brianna. With the beard. With Brianna. Sometime after the shooting. Within the past 3 weeks. I know the scene. The house, the truck, the people. It's Mitch, standing in Brianna's driveway. They are at the end of something, a conversation, perhaps. I see them hug. Mitch rubs her back and then lets her go. They don't kiss, but they do linger. I can't hear their parting words or even see their mouths as they move, but I can tell they're speaking, even as Mitch gets into his truck. Wade was on the road in front of the house when he filmed this. It has a fully exposed, sprawling front lawn, so he would have no trouble parking and recording through the window. There's an unobstructed view from the curb up the entire driveway to the house. Mitch would have noticed the blue truck there, which means Wade has access to a different vehicle. This is confirmed by the second message, which contains a photo of our officers in their SUV at the Ridgeway Shopping Center. I can tell from the angle that it was taken through a car window parked across the median. Wade was there today, in a different car. A third message comes in now, short and to the point. They don't deserve you. I am disturbed by the video of my husband and his mistress. I can still feel his body wrapped against mine just a few hours ago. But this photo from the parking lot causes a different reaction. I study the angle, just like we did at the school, where he must have been in the parking lot with the median. Then I think about where I'd left a bicycle chained to a rack with a camera attached beneath the seat. I told no one, not even Rowan. I've already kept so much from him, gone down this road too far. I can tell from Wade's picture catching our team outside the diner that I have also caught him on my camera. He's in a car. I can see a piece of the rearview mirror in his photo. I'm not arrogant.